Yes. Yes. Okay. And so then the other ones that we're keeping, is everybody clear about the other ones that we're keeping?
Okay. Alice, your sentiment was national core indicators.
Yes.
Which everybody,
yes,
I think, nodded to. Then we have the other Council of Quality and Leadership Personal Outcome Measures, which is a different 40-year experience accrediting organization.
So I'm personally, just in terms of the spread of the NCI and the reason and the fact that it's fixing to be adapted to a broader population is why I was putting that one on the table. If anybody has a strong recommendation for the other one to also be part of our recommendation set. So, yes, on the table, yes.
Would you also be willing to get somebody here to talk, if you haven't heard somebody discuss what the ICF is all about? It might be worth a presentation at some point. Get John Hoff from the CDC, who's kind of the HHS expert on that.
For future.
It's a very interesting classification system that covers the whole gamut of things, including health. It's disability, health, and function.
So I'm looking for anyone who wants to speak up in favor of including a second, the other personal outcomes group. Amita, can you turn on your mic?
My question is more specific to the tools that are suggested here. So question is that an organization or a program might already be collecting these measures but using some other tool. Using some other tool which is standardized. Switching tools can be cost burdensome. And, since one of the objectives is to make sure that data burdens are not enhanced in the selection of measures, the process, I think, would encompass the fact that the tools, that are being used by the program should still consider to be valid. So has there been any attempt or questions raised about normalizing the results that are achieved from different tools? And the reason I'm asking this is because we are facing this issue at NPA. So... and they're struggling with this. So, you could have tools that have 10 scales or scales of 5. Well, what is superior excellent in terms of patient experience? So the question is, if you were to look at 4 or 5 or 6 standardized tools that are being widely used, that are accepted by the community, then how do we go about normalizing the results?
I think the short answer is no. Normalization so far as, there's, one of NQF's roles in the endorsement process is if there's a couple of measures that are really, really similar, then the endorsement committee goes through a process of saying, how do these sync up and is there a way to, what is your word for that, harmonize? Is there a way to harmonize them? But in terms of like the huge variety, CAPS, the closest to normalization that occurs is CAPS because that, in order to add in a new survey concept to the family of CAPS surveys, like the home and community-based survey stuff has gone through, is you take the concepts that are important in home and community-based services and then you normalize the questions into the CAPS, the CAPS framework of asking questions and response categories. But in terms of any of these other ones like CARE or like NCI or whatever, no, I think, those are, very, very different from each other. And that's one of the actually really good things about some of these others like NCI and the patient outcome, or what is the other one, personal outcome. I can keep losing the acronym. So that's, one of the good things is that the response options are so very different from just the, sometimes, always, never. They're really more like the, I think we talked in the webinar last month about, are measures meaningful to the consumers who read the reports out of them, and it's like very meaningful. I mean, I totally agree with what Sean is saying. It's meaningful to read a report that says, of the people who responded to this survey, a certain percent said, I control what time I get up in the morning and whether I, you know, whether somebody makes me go to bed at night, and I control who comes in and out of the place that I live. And I mean, those are really meaningful concepts to people in a way that is very different.
Suzanne, I have a comment to make.
Yeah, go ahead, Ann.
So I'm trying to track the broad range of conversations we're having. It struck me that there's sort of two categories. There's the piece out of that you just brought, the whole locus of control, and measures related to that, which are kind of morphed between home and community services and also sort of some medical care overlap. But then on the list, there's a whole quality of life piece around home pain management. And I didn't know if we had gone to that kind of conversation yet, but I think that's, for me at least, that's the two kind of areas, right? There's this HCBS piece that encompasses locus of control and family dynamic issues and a bunch of other areas. And then there's a big one that all these categories care about, all these populations, which is, you know, is my pain controlled? And it overlaps in a lot of different areas.
So pain is coming up under the same category of quality of life. You're right. And we were about to tackle it, maybe not
okay.
Next, but really soon. Thank you for bringing it up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sort of hearing Sean's point, too, about, I mean, it's not just the other survey that we haven't heard about yet. I've been carrying around this paper that Stephen Kay did for the DREDS, is that the right acronym, about quality of life measures. And it seems like, you know, we've kind of only scratched the surface of some of these other ones. We haven't really, you know, there's a list of, you know, a dozen, 15 different personal experience surveys, and I kind of hate to get too far.
There's a whole framework for measuring quality of life that's been developed by the World Health
right.
Organization called
right.
Quality of Life 100, and then there's a short version that's used in various places in Europe, and I think there's like 26 different domains that are conceptualized in that framework. So
I'm kind of feeling like it's something that we need to come back and revisit and dedicate, you know, just more concentrated time on rather than just picking off ones because we have just recently heard about.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, it's not something we can solve now, but I think we would just want it noted that quality of life, where quality of life is on the measurement isn't representative of what we would think the whole field is.
All right, so it's like lunch is here. It's 10 till. I would really love to be able to cover these next couple subtopics under the quality of life area before we break for lunch. So can we kind of leave where we are and move on to health-related quality of life and advanced illness care? And I think Leonardo is ready to talk about those two.
Yeah, I moved them from my computer notes to here, so this should be a little easier. So there's 1.2, which there's only two measures. The first one is a quality of life and function assessment related to dialysis. And the second is fairly narrow related to COPD and involves some HRQOL score that I have no idea what that means. But
health-related quality of life.
So both of those are fairly narrow. Of the two, the first one seems a little bit broader because it at least included functioning within it. But I really, since I didn't understand the other one, I wasn't really clear as to why these are sort of separated.
Yeah, and I didn't think they were particularly relevant, so I was not recommending them.
So if we have to give up another couple of measures, you could live without them. Yeah.
But let's talk about quality of life measures that aren't there especially for these populations being a gap.
Yeah, being a huge gap, right. The next couple are about pain, right?
Right. So the tricky thing about these is they've been put in the correct numerical order in terms of measure number, which then takes them out of logical order. So in sort of buckets, there are two that deal with pain in the home. There are three that deal with pain at hospice. There are advanced care planning type of measures that apply at home facility or ICU level. So that would sort of, and looking at them, I liked the four of the home ones. 420 is the one I liked a little bit better than 177, but not by a significant margin. And of the hospice ones, I liked 209 and 1637. And I was trying to decide which of those I liked better. My overarching, and then the advanced care planning, you know, there's one for home, one for facility, and one for ICU. What's weird about that to me is, you know, at ICU, at the point of the ICU, of course, you have a lot of reasons to be talking about advanced care planning, but I don't know that that's the place that I would want to become the norm for that conversation to happen. So even though it might be a really important place to be talking about it, I would rather have us focus on measuring that in the more normal environments so that it's not something we talk about only when there's an emergency kind of situation. And trying to map all of these onto our charge, which is these special needs populations, I thought pain at home was especially important, and I'm not sure. I had trouble sort of mapping pain at hospice to this purpose we're talking about here. Maybe others would feel differently about it.
Well, and can you remind which of the advanced planning measures we talked about yesterday being appropriate for subpopulations, because we don't want to necessarily lose track of that one?
That was part of the update. So in column G electronically, which is like right after the basic measure information and it's clustered with the other type of MAP recommendations, we can see where we supported it for use with people with disabling behavioral and cognitive conditions. So that is 177, 326, 420, and 1626.
So you endorsed those yesterday? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so 177 I liked, but I think you would compare that one to 420 and ask why would we have both?
I agree, and I was less enthusiastic about the 177.
177 is in the middle of page 8, and 420 is in the middle of page 9. And I'm totally open to being wrong about that. It's just that was my read of it.
Yeah, it's just a different level of analysis, home health versus ambulatory care.
Give up one. You guys would be okay with giving up 177. And, well, actually, we're giving up quite a few, right? So we'd be left with 1626, 326, and 420. Is that right? Those would be the 1626, 326, and 420. So 1626, now I've got myself back into the wrong section. I see what you mean about how these are kind of in the...
Right. So here's the thing about... 1626, which is the ICU
one.
When we looked at advanced care plan, I don't know that we were looking at 1641, for example. So if you told me that should we have an advanced care plan, if you asked me should we have an advanced care plan measure for the ICU, I would say yes.
Mm-hmm.
But if you asked me you can only have one advanced care plan measure, would you rather have it at the ICU the facility level or the, you know, regular ambulatory level, I'm not sure I would pick ICU because I don't know where that's the long-term place we want that to happen in the system.
Got it. So well, 326 is a broader measure, and the main weakness there being the 65 and older, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Well, but I would argue that the ICU, if they don't have one, then it really needs to be discussed there because a tremendous amount of care goes on in the ICU and post-ICU that oftentimes the patient doesn't desire, and it's just never discussed because they're in the ICU, so you don't want to discuss it. So I really would support 1626.
Yeah. So as long as we don't have to, which Sarah's saying, no, we don't have to drop that many. We can keep them.
Anne, I have a comment related to that.
Yeah, go ahead, Anne.
So the one comment that came up last time for young people with physical disabilities, and I think it would apply for folks with mental illness and DD, is that if it's done in the ICU, that folks aren't pressured to not take steps to do as much care as they feel they need, or that the families aren't pressured.
Yeah.
And I don't know how we note that, but I think it's pretty important for us.
Thanks. Will do. That's sort of on my keeping lists of issues with measures and list of gaps, and I'd say that's an issue with measures.
So Alice, have we specifically said that there's a gap with measuring pain for people who are cognitively impaired in IDD because you have to use different instruments and tools in order to accurately assess pain in those pockets?
Now we have it. Thank you. That was another really good thing about that New Yorker article. I highly recommend that New Yorker article, by the way. So anything else of this group that you people feel strongly about keeping in the family of measures?
Okay, so 1.3, we have eliminated number 260, assessment of health-related quality of life.
Sorry, 1.3. It's number 177 is the first one. Improvement of pain interfering with activity. It was preferred for 420.
Can you just read the ones that are in?
Are in or out? You asked for out. So out. Answer is out. 177, improvement of pain interfering with activity. 209, comfortable dieting. 1634, hospice and palliative care pain screening. 1641, hospice and palliative care treatment preferences. 1647, percent of hospice patients with documentation in the clinical record of discussion of spiritual religious concerns. I don't know if there's a decision on 1626, patient submitted is in, okay. 171, that's the next section. Anybody lose one of those measures that you feel strongly about wanting to keep? Deb?
I have that it is in with a note of different instruments and tools are needed for communication with the IDDD population. Is that correct? 1637?
No, that was more of a general comment about pain. Pain assessment broadly needs to the measurement needs to reflect the needs of using other methods of assessment.
hospice ones, eliminating the hospice ones, the main reason was just too narrow, or what?
Too narrow of a setting. Well, these kinds of things are going to go on in hospice. I think that's the other issue.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when some of the nursing home measures that we took off the plate, it's because, you know, these things are going to be measured and tracked, and there is no question but that if you are a hospice patient, these things are going to be assessed on your back.
Steve, I think it also goes to the question of whether we're targeting our list, you know, FMI or not, because that was why I asked why we would be focused on pain management in hospice as special for the subpopulation we're talking about. That was my question.
Well, Leon, now we're back to all duals for purposes
of
the family.
We're back to
let's blow it back up to all 9 million and some. So if that changes the recommendation, we should discuss that.
There are a large number of people with Alzheimer's disease. It's like the second category after cancer in hospice. So.
Yeah, the other thing is, if I understand it correctly, we are keeping one on pain in hospice, which is 1637.
It's an excellent point, though. I think similar to what we did with pressure ulcers in the nursing home, that they're going to be looking at that and everybody intensely. And so if you're in hospice, whether you're dual eligible or not, they're going to be looking at these things intensely. Do we think that they should be selected out as a priority for dual eligible populations over and above anybody else in hospice, I guess? So that's why you're saying we can take them off our list, maybe. One of them is?
I thought 1637 was on the list.
So we're
eliminating some hospice measures because we have one. So we had three that were, there were literally three that were pain in hospice, 209, 1634, and 1637. And so we kept 1637.
Everybody is not into that. Okay, so no other like major objections? Okay. We are, at this moment, what we're going to do is have a little quick opportunity for public comment, especially because I know we're going to lose one of our public commenters before with the next opportunity. So could you jump up and, while he's coming to the microphone, operator, could you instruct the people on the phone if they want to make a public comment, please?
At this time, to make that comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad.
Thank you. Go ahead, Tom.
You know, there's nothing like coming to the microphone before lunch to ruin people's quality of life. There were three comments that I wanted to make. So this is going to take you back a few hours, but it's expected. I want to raise three things. First has to do with the issue of who is being measured. When we look across the spreadsheet, it says measure use. It doesn't say anything about accountability. And in fact, it's because some of these are very nebulous. We had this discussion today. It points back to what I was saying yesterday, that we really need to have more measures of systemness. And I'll leave it at that, but to say that when you take particularly things like the flu shot, flu shots can be reported in the hospital, and that was one of the discussions. But it's not going to be captured. There's how do we know whether any of these measures that are really good intended measures and are ones that have an impact on a population can be adequately measured. That's the problem with accountability. Second thing, Paul, and I want to echo what Dr. Andrews said about supporting measure 0141. Jenny Shanhansen, who was on this body with me last year, and I were very much in favor of that. CDC says that 45 to 1,000 falls per year in this population is significant. To say we're only going to look at those where there's an injury is kind of like saying we don't care about texting while you're driving until you have an accident. And the third point is with medication safety.
I'm not sure about it.
Right to that here for us all. Comment. If you look at studies I've had of North Carolina, using medication reconciliation in the hospital is not an index at all of what people are actually taking. Where this is now is really a gap that I'm raising. We need to have measures of what's going on in the home. Just like you have people going into the home, and AmeriHealth has people going into the home, we find huge variations. So I would just raise that as a gap. Thank you.
Operator, anybody on the phone indicating an interest in commenting?
There are no comments over the phone.
Anybody else in the room? Okay, we are going to have a little bit shortened break for lunch. If everybody could get back here by 12:30, we would really appreciate it, and enjoy your lunch. Thanks. As we say in the summer river rafting season that we are getting into. The next section is care planning and transitions. Am I right? Yes. Well, care coordination and safety is a big overall topic. And the subtopics under care coordination and safety are care planning and transitions, safety, med management, which we dealt with about half of the groups this morning, so we have a handful more to talk about this afternoon. Falls, imaging, and cultural competence. Imaging. Hopefully that will be quick. So care planning and transitions is up first. Do you want to orient us to where these are on the table? Okay.
Alice, I was talking with Clark, and we thought that we might summarize proposed measures to drop.
We'd be delighted to hear your
from this
summary.
Section, and maybe approach it that way. I'll give a quick summary. This is, you know, with the care coordination and safety, these different measures, you know, transitions of care and medications, these are, as we've discussed, you know, one of the more important areas. So there's not a lot, I think, out of the numerous measures here that we think that we can potentially drop, but here we go with the ones that maybe we can. I'm starting in section 2.1, and the first one is 0265, hospital transfer admission. This is the rate of ambulatory surgical care admissions requiring a hospital transfer. Essentially, it's just a pretty narrow area. We could drop the ambulatory surgery center measure. The next one, Clark pointed out, 0557. Might be dropped because there's some redundancy with the next one, 0558, which tends to, 0558 appears to include everything in 0557, but just adds the requirement that there's a transmission to the next level of care of the discharge plan.
Those so are paired measures and should be used together. You need the first to
calculate. You need one for the other. We couldn't figure that out from reading the two, but just
you, you would have to be psychic to know that, or remember the prior conversation about these measures. That's why we have both.
All right. And the next few involve follow-up after hospitalization, mental health, timely transitions of records, all very important. The next one we thought might be able to drop two of them, actually, that are specific to, I think this needs a correction, too. It's 0698 on page 19 of the handout. I just 2.1 NQF 0698. This is 30-day post-hospital acute MI discharge care transition composite measure. Under the measure description, it has heart failure there. That needs to be corrected, I think. Because the next one, then, 0699, is heart failure. I think we've got enough around 30-day readmissions and ED visits and such that these are very focused on diagnoses, certainly common in the dual eligibles, but I think we might be able to drop The next one comes under the safety section. That's 0139. It's the central line associated bloodstream infection. I think these were ones to be discussed maybe yesterday that we didn't get time for. But this seems to be, an issue in sick people in the hospital, whether they're duals or not. So. Pressure ulcer, I would keep those, as we've talked about. The next one thought we could drop was a few pages down, 1799. This is medication management on page 29 of the handout at the top, still in section 2.3, 1799, medication management for people with asthma. This, again, we've got a lot on medication management and is specific to asthma. I'm not sure that it adds a whole lot to the other measures that are more broadly applied.
Do we need all this fall stuff again?
I think we need all the fall stuff, except we could potentially, I went back and forth on 0266, 2.4, bottom of page 31. This is patient fall in an ambulatory surgical center. I decided, well, that's probably still important. If it's important in the other settings, keep it there. But if Maddie wants to propose dropping it, I won't.
What I was trying to understand was, given that we just got finished talking about falls, are we just repeating ourselves, or did we defer from this morning till now to these measures?
I'm not recommending that we drop any of the falls measures that we've discussed.
Okay.
And then the last two that thought we could drop were from prior sessions, page 33, both of these, 2.5, 0668, appropriate head CT imaging in adults with mild traumatic brain injury. And 0755, appropriate cervical spine radiography and CT imaging and trauma. Both important in trauma care, certainly, but I don't know that they're anything different in duals compared to others and are pretty focused. So. I think that totals 7.
Thank you. Very helpful. Juliana?
Just wanted to thank you for going over my assignment, too.
I'm sorry.
No, because actually, just to reiterate, we'll make it go quicker, and Alice will love that. I agreed on the on the asthma measure and the two CT measures. And then I just have, notes again on the, the med rec measures, just trying to get the, good broad coverage, but there's no perfect measure, but I don't think we need to rehash that. Just probably capture the notes from our earlier discussion.
Thanks. So we'll maybe take them one category at a time. Under the care planning and transition, what's on the table is to drop, now you'll have to keep me honest here, 0265. And 698, is that one the transition measure? Yes.
And
699. So on the table is to drop 265, 698, and 699. Is everybody okay with that? Right? Next, on the safety list, dropping 139. And that's the only one under safety, right? Oh, everybody
right.
Okay with dropping 139?
Yeah. Okay. I should make special note dinner with the National Association of Public Hospitals and Health Systems folks last night that specifically wanted to keep the CAUTI, the urinary tract infection outcome measure, is that they found in their quality work in the hospitals across the safety net and under served populations that that does seem to distinguish, delineate quality of care among complex and, you know, low-income folks.
Great. Under the med management, the only one that we talked about dropping was 1799, which is the one specific to asthma controller. So just, again, because we promised that we would talk about medications, again, this afternoon, we have medication reconciliation post-discharge and then the reconciled medication list received by discharge patients. So folks okay with those, keep those two and only drop the asthma one. Yep, good.
Yes, and this gets at Valerie's suggested addition, at least one of them here, on page 26. Use of high-risk medications in the elderly. I guess, was that a carryover from our core group, I guess? I don't think we have considered the drug-disease interaction item. And was there another one you were thinking about, persistent medications?
Do we have that on our packet? No. Okay. So the one that we do have is the 0022 use of high-risk medications in the elderly, and that was under the safety, but good one for med management too. Juliana, go ahead.
That's one. What number is that?
I did notice a gap on the med management part in this family. There's not really anything on nursing home care, and I, you could use the antipsychotic measure. That's really the only one on nursing home compare that's somewhat close.
Do we have that leftover from yesterday, the antipsychotic in nursing home?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll bring that one over. Sounds good.
This population.
Clark?
I wanted to comment, even though Sarah responded, on 0057 and 0058, and I know they're part of 7 Joint Commission, but...
I'm sorry, reorient me. Where
we're on page 13 for 2.10557 and page 14... 2.10558. So Steve and I had talked about dropping 57 and keeping 58. All 57 says is you have to have a discharge plan, a piece of paper. 58 says you have to have a comprehensive plan and all elements, and you have to transmit it to the next level provider. So you can't do 58 without 57. And both 57 and 58 miss a lot of essential things about person-centeredness. There's no requirement for the person or their family or caregiver where appropriate to be involved, to accept the discharge plan, or to get a copy of the plan. And best practice in psychiatric hospital is the hospital actually makes the appointment, not they send it on to the next level provider, but they actually make the appointment and say, your appointment with the community mental health center is 2 weeks from Thursday. So the standards are incomplete from my view, and I know they're packaged together, but I don't, you have to have 57 in order to do 58. So I don't, and if we, our burden is you want 60 and we got to reduce, I don't see the value of 57, since you have to have 57 to do 58.
Yeah, do you either, right, that's paired, the way paired measures work, you either have both of them or you have neither of them. So it's, I think it's up to the group if you want to have, if there's strong will to have neither. Okay. We can certainly indicate that as a gap. Yeah, totally. So, okay, so we dispensed all the way down to Falls, right? Falls, your recommendation was keep all the Falls measures. Anybody have any, even the one for ambulatory surgery, yes, they said keep all the Falls measures. Drop 668 and 755, the imaging. Nods, Sean, do you have a comment about that one or it's different? Okay, look, let's dispense with imaging real quick. So those are the last two to drop were the two imaging ones that are really specific. So, okay. All right, so Sean, take us back.
Just a gap on the discharge planning that there is some measure or including in these measures in the plan so that there's an that they understand or have recommendations about specific community-based services the person might need. So it's just to reinforce the discharge planning that includes community-based services.
So noted.
Does the area with the most gaps get pushed to the top of the list at some point?
That's maybe a HRSA and CMS question. Just weighing in on gaps over and over help reinforce for you guys that, yes, we really need to deal with these gaps.
And you have an opportunity to reprioritize them every time you send in the report.
I just wanted to provide a context. So we take 5758 for granted, discharge planning. The Department of Justice is in Nevada because the Nevada State Psychiatric Hospital for 18 months, their discharge plan has been to purchase a Greyhound bus ticket for the person's choice of city in California. So they can go to Sacramento or San Diego, and they give them a little piece of paper that says, this is the Community Mental Health Center address. So there's incompleteness and the reality, and then there's reality of what certain providers are practicing. And it is just disgraceful that in this year, Nevada is doing that. I lived through this with Mississippi doing this to Tennessee 30 years ago and thought maybe the Greyhound bus thing was over, but it's not.
CMS did called into task because they failed to follow the conditions of participation that are required underneath the Medicare and the Medicaid program. So, yes, it was a poor discharge plan, but there were other things in place that in theory might have helped.
So we didn't talk about, but it seems like people have been bringing up over and over about the importance of cultural competency, and so we're going to keep those two measures on cultural competency is what we have. And
I did want to point that out. I was amiss in not doing that. It's on page 35. We definitely want to keep those two measures that have been, that's now in our core set, the cultural competence caps, and then the next page is, or the page before, I guess, sorry, is the health literacy.
Great. So that's the family measures for care coordination and safety. Any last thoughts or words on any of this area? Valerie?
I just wanted to talk for a second about care transitions, and I mentioned this issue. That is in this section, right? I mentioned this issue yesterday. Our members feel that many of the care transition measures are very focused on administrative data and whether you did certain things and, communicated information back and forth between providers and that, but that there should be more of a focus on outcomes. And some of the things that our members think would be helpful in this regard would be, and this first one isn't necessarily a care transition measure directly, but I think it fits in, the percentage of members that are assigned a behavioral case manager could be a good one for people in the SPMI or the SMI category, maybe the substance abuse category. The percentage of new members with reduction in behavioral health hospitalization missions, within 1 year of enrollment using the first 6 months as the baseline, and the percentage of new members with reduction in ER visits, again, using the first 6 months as a baseline. I mean, some of our members have been tremendously successful in reducing admissions, hospital admissions and ER admissions for new patients coming into substance abuse and mental health service areas, and I don't know whether there are existing measures that would capture that, but those are the kind of outcome measures that, as I had mentioned yesterday, if you're reducing hospital admissions and ER, you're definitely having an impact on transitions, because those are obviously where people falling through the cracks in transitions often end up back in the ER or the hospital. So we would support, at least in the report, you know, making the notation of greater use of outcome measures for transitions.
I would support that.
General support for including those concepts of focusing on outcomes and specifically the ones that were mentioned. Yes? Maybe?
The data also are showing, the published data are also showing that reductions in hospital admissions and ER visits for behavioral health patients are credited with achieving very large cost savings in to healthcare dollars. I know that's not our charge, but to reduce costs, but helpful to know.
Samantha?
I just have a question I would pose to the group in the discussion on care coordination, and yesterday folks brought up the issue of social determinants of health and mentioned housing and other aspects, and so do the group have thoughts on measurement gaps or needs and looking at how you coordinate care to the community, to community service providers?
Helpful. Thanks. Okay, so congratulations to us. We are going to move on to screening and assessment. So the areas here are preventive care, vaccinations, chronic disease management, and functional status. I don't know, Samantha and Valerie, if you have managed to do this efficient process, but we should have probably gotten everybody to do these little pre-meetings. Like,
hey,
Cloud,
you did that really
fast. Yep. Go ahead, Samantha.
So I apologize. So let's see. I'm just a policy person here, but I bring with you some input from my brilliant clinical informatics colleagues here. So in looking at the NQF 0029, folks liked that concept. They thought it could be very process-oriented. In looking at 0032, NQF 0032 on page 37, that's actually one of the measures that we in HRSA identified as one of the measures that matter most to measure across our bureau and office programs, as is the NQF 0421 measure. We liked the NQF 0573 measure. I apologize, I'm not sure if our office of our Bureau of HIV AIDS is using that measure or not. We wanted to check on that, and I don't know. I apologize. For the NQF 2152 measure, I thought yesterday folks said that this is going through the steering committee. If it does get endorsement, then we thought this was a strong measure as well. Let's see. I'm on, if someone can, what page is 1659 on? Let me see.
40.
Okay, so 40. I believe when we identified this as one of a measurement gap areas when we looked across our agency, so that's a good measure. The NQF 0018, the high blood pressure, that is one of the measures that, again, HRSA identified as one of the measures to measure across our bureaus and offices. It also is a measure that the department identified as well through the MPC for that purpose. We liked NQF 079. That's a composite measure, and I would support using composite measures more frequently. And then finally, the NQF, the 2082, is one of the measures that our HAB, the Bureau of HIV/AIDS, and HRSA uses, and so we support that as well. So this is coming kind of broader from a HRSA perspective and honing in at the duals population level, so you have to balance that with and add that to your duals focus, if that helps.
Okay. Valerie, do you want to weigh in first before we move?
Please.
Sorry. You know, thinking about the fact that we're focused on these four particular high-risk groups, I'm not sure physical activity and cervical cancer screening are sort of a higher, it sort of goes in that high-risk category of measures. The body mass index we talked about yesterday, and we think that's really important. On the AIDS screening measures, which include... the screening measure, which is the 0573, we're very supportive of. And then there's another measure on page 43. It's measure 2082. It's the HIV viral load suppression. Our AIDS plans say that you could get 100% on every HEDIS HOS TAPS measure, and if you don't do the viral load and CD4 counts, that you basically fail, because those are the most important things for AIDS. And the viral load count is really important, because if you have less than the 200 copies per ml, that means that you move from the HIV into the AIDS category. So that's really important. The one question I wanted to raise on the AIDS measures, though, is, and I'm assuming that the AIDS measures would be most important for SPMI, SMI, which we know have a slightly higher percentage of AIDS than, say, your average stool, and the SUD as well. There's two other measures in addition to the viral load suppression that are recommended by the U.S., DHSS recommendations. And one is retention in HIV medical care. They look at in the numerator, it looks like the number of persons with an HIV diagnosis who had at least one HIV medical care visit in each six-month period of the 24-month measurement period, with a minimum of 60 days between the first medical visit in the six prior month period and the last medical visit in the subsequent six-month period. And USDHS recommendation there, our members have said that would reduce the risk of clinical progression, complications, or death, and to deal with opportunistic infections. And then there's the third one would be the antiretroviral therapy among persons in HIV medical care, where the number of persons with an HIV diagnosis who are prescribed ART in the 12-month measurement period. And since these have been recommended, I was wondering whether you could set it up so that if, when you have the screening done, and it shows that you're below the 200 measure count, that maybe for those people, these other two measures would then go into focus and would be put in place. But if you were over the 200, then you wouldn't need to have these other two. So I would recommend consideration of that on the AIDS. And then going back to, I think we dealt this morning with the prevention for, the vaccinations. Oh, I know. I'm on page 40. 0680, percentage of residents who were assessed given the seasonal influenza vaccine. And then the next one, 1659, the influenza immunization. I was wondering whether those, and maybe we've made that decision this morning and I don't remember, but are they both needed? It seems like they're kind of similar and that maybe the second one would be encapsulated in the first one?
One is short stay.
Oh, okay, short stay versus long stay. Okay. Okay, and then the only other comment I guess I had was the percentage of residents who've had a catheter inserted and left long term in the bladder. Is the reason for doing this to make sure it doesn't happen? Because our people said that they thought that, you know, the catheters in these populations weren't really appropriate, and for except under certain circumstances. For example, if you had a stroke and that was the only way that you were going to be able to eliminate the urine. And then the other thing is that the concern was that people with dementia would pull out the catheter and you'd have to put mittens on them basically as kind of a restraint, which wasn't really highly recommended. So there were some concerns about that. So
yeah, I think this is one of those measures that if it goes up, it's bad, right?
I'm sorry?
Yeah, if it goes up, it's bad. This isn't what a measure of good quality care.
Which one is
bad quality?
It's the number 0686, the percent of residents who had a catheter inserted and left in their bladder. So this is trying to say we shouldn't be doing this, so we better screen and make sure it doesn't happen. Okay, great. So we would support that. Those are my comments.
Thank you. Ruth? Has there been any discussion about whether or not for the elderly who may have disabilities or dementia to receive herpes zoster vaccine to prevent shingles? Because that's tremendously painful, can be very debilitating, has a lot of sequelae, and I think if it's can be preventable.
Yeah. Good point.
We should put that on our gap list. I don't know if there's an existing endorsed measure yet. No. So we should put that on the gap list. So just the measures we haven't had any mention of?
In the group of preventive care through functional, we talked about immunizations. We didn't really talk, we talked a little bit about chronic disease. We didn't talk much about functional status. So any that are in this group that people haven't mentioned, so these are the ones that if nobody speaks up, we would drop them. So go ahead.
I'm pretty sure I missed one, if not two, that was mentioned, excuse me. So 0043, pneumonia vaccination adult status for older adults. 1825, COPD management for poorly controlled COPD. 430, change in daily activity function as measured by the AMPAC. 0688, percent of residents who need help with activities of daily living that has increased long stay. That's it.
So four on the table for letting go of anybody wants to comment on these that we just mentioned would be dropped with?
I should have kept the COPD one. I didn't mention that because we talked about it yesterday. I think that's a really important one, the management of the COPD.
Okay.
Could you repeat those again? I'm
so
sorry,
there's the two AMPAC ones, right? Two AMPAC measures, which are... now I'm too far.
Change in daily activity function. And that's all I have. But then there's also percent of residents who need help with activities of daily living that has increased.
So any strong support for 688 or 430?
688 is where?
What page?
Generators whose need for help has increased. Why would we eliminate these two functional measures? It's one of the focuses that we've had for quite a while, especially in dual populations. We're trying to optimize function, and it's so often kind of not prioritized in the medical arena.
I think that's the reason it got in the list, is there wasn't anything much better. It's kind of like the only one that we had at our disposal, with all of its flaws.
So I would propose we keep those for those same reasons. Flawed measures, but keeping the focus on really important concepts.
So if we drop the 0043 pneumonia vaccine, does that change anything that we did yesterday in terms of the recommendations that we made to flu vaccines and all the subgroups? Okay, good. Yay. So we got rid of one, and that's all. Leo.
Yeah, so my only reaction to in this section, I feel like it's a little weird. I mean, you asked me screening on cervical cancer, BMI, HIV, pneumonia, COPD, they're all important. And I could have just listed, right, 50 things that we would all think are important screenings. So I think, you know, unlike other sections where we might have had five measures doing relatively the same thing, and what we're trying to do is pick the best measure, I think here we have two questions, right? One is, which are actually good measures at doing whatever they're saying they're going to do, which I'm not qualified to answer in most cases. And then the other question is, you know, do we think it's an important thing? And I just think that this is an area where there's going to have to be some kind of priority setting, because, you know, all of us feel like there are a lot of important things that we should be screening. So what are the, you know, this goes back to those early charts we had with, like, what are the top 10 illnesses that are affecting duals?
And on the other hand, maybe we'll just end up with a really big family.
Yeah, I personally don't worry much about creating burden for people, but, you know, that might just be my perspective.
Maybe we should recommend somebody make a composite of some key screening measures that...
That's what Mady was kind of arguing for earlier today, is working on composites. So that's a, yeah. Instead of care for older adults, it could be like screening measures for older adults or screening measures for duals or whatever. So, okay, I think we have ended up being happy with the ones that we have minus 0043 Steve.
Just a clarification. So 0043, the pneumonia vaccine, that is included somewhere else. That's why we're dropping it here? Or?
It came up for the frail elders in the previous meeting. But if we eliminate it here, it won't move forward.
I thought it was cognitive impairment today, too. Didn't we talk about it this morning?
Didn't we talk about it?
Something, but I think it was a similar measure, but it could apply either way. It seems like we might want to keep it in to be consistent at the expense of parsimony.
I'm all about getting to everything we need to get to. Clark?
I think it was a point that George had made this morning. Yeah.
I have a request of the staff, which means additional work, but it would be helpful to cluster all of these measures by the high priority subpopulations, because that's, I know I'm going to be asked at the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, 110 disability organizations, which measures for which populations, and if that's not too unreasonable, it would be really helpful.
We have a start at that. We know which ones were recommended for either
the previous two, and then we're still sorting out the recommendations from this meeting, but that won't be hard to represent in the deliverable.
So, okay, hang tight one second. Okay, we're going to walk through ahead to the next little topic area then on mental health and substance use. And again, so Sarah, you go ahead.
Sure. We're just going to skip through our break because we're doing this really quickly. And we are now in the mental health substance use high leverage opportunity, which is exactly the conversation that we've been having already in this meeting. So rather than, rehash, we have guidance from you about whether you think those measures apply to all duals or some, assortment within. There is just one measure left in your sheet that hasn't already been discussed during this meeting, or it has been, but it was tagged as a more general measure than one for the subgroups, and that is in category 4, number 418, preventive care and screening. So this is like a general population screening for depression. It was not thought to be appropriate for the SMI group because you need to have this before you get in the SMI group. So there's lots of programs already using this measure, a number of states. It is ambulatory care oriented, so I think we would look to our reviewers here, but it seems as if the discussion has indicated support for this at a family level.
Yeah, maybe. But by the way, it is not necessary to have clinical depression to be in the SMI group. You can be schizophrenic, and you can be bipolar, and have bipolar, and not have clinical depression.
Not the only.
So the Preventive Task Force does not recommend, it's not a recommendation for children 12 and over. Does that matter for this? It is not their recommended.
Be another modification we suggest to the measure?
For adults.
Seems like a good note to take. Not very many duals between 12 and 18, so probably less important for our recommendations, but ought to be carried forward.
MH.
Sean?
There's a new DSM out now, DSM-5. So does that mean all these screening tools need to be re-evaluated? There are some changes, I think, to some of the criteria for some of the categories of depression and others. acceptance, just, you know, to maybe put it down as a possible, you know, thing to look at. If I even use it.
The wording might have to change in some of these, because I don't think in the DSM-5 they any longer characterize things like drug dependence. It is now substance use disorders, and it's a level of severity. So I would think one of the things that we would want somebody to do, maybe the stewards of the measures, is to go back and just make sure that the coding is correct for the numerators and the denominators given the new DSM-5. They kind of need to pay attention to that, because regardless of disputes, it will be in use.
Sally. I'm clicking on another one of the mental health substance abuse measures, so can we go on to that? Yeah, my question is, we have book 28, which is about tobacco use screening and cessation intervention, and then also 27. And so I'm wondering if they're unlike Leo, I sometimes do worry about burden over, you know, loading out too much. There seems to be somewhat duplicative, although the data source is different. There's a patient survey on 27, and it's claims data mainly on 28. But they seem to be getting at the same thing, both, you know, was the screening done for tobacco use, and then was there some sort of tobacco cessation intervention included? So I'm just wondering if they're, you know, in the interest of harmonization, could we combine, or is there one that's more comprehensive to recommend? Do we really need both to recommend?
We're checking on the level of analysis. I suspect that might be why there's two.
These are the two that we did talk about at some length yesterday, and we
that was in here yesterday.
Yeah. So I think that was why people were supporting them both going forward. It's just the difference in how the data is collected. I mean, we didn't drop either one of those, right?
No, we didn't.
Yeah. Ruth, did you have a comment? Okay. So we're happy with the mental health and substance use set, then, as happy as we can be. You're never 100% happy. Give us the caveats on all these measures. We're going to move ahead to the structural measures.
I'm sorry, we just realized that there's different versions of these sheets floating around. Could you just tell me what measure and what page we're on? The one that was passed out is different than the one that's online. So,
everyone should have gotten either an electronic version from a flash drive this morning from a staff member, or a hard copy this morning from a staff member. If you don't have one of those, you're not looking at the most up-to-date information that would include yesterday's results. So if you need one, let us know. Happy to give it to you.
They've assured me that I do have the most up-to-date one, but I was trying to find my place. But
wait. I'm sorry, I don't have the hard copy
myself.
Thank
you. I apologize.
Page 48.
Page 48. Thank you.
There's just a limited number of structural measures that are carried forward. Again, brought forward, you know, for your consideration, because they've been highlighted in the past as useful. I think we'll just turn it over to our reviewers in this section, who are Sally, because Chip isn't here with us today.
to see if you have any further input on the structural measures, and we can have general discussion about them following up.
Generally, 486 is e-prescribing. Straightforward. 526, timely initiation of care, also pretty straightforward. The medical home system survey, I don't know personally I guess I'm not as familiar with the six categories there that are being measured, of the six composites. I don't know. Someone with some more knowledge about this may have some input there, because I'm just not familiar with the six composites. I did have a question on the cultural competency, again, the implementation measure there, because I don't know what is it's the adherence to 12 of the 45 NQF endorsed cultural competency practices. So is that any 12, or that is, again, a 12 recommended out of the 45? Is it a subset of 12 recommended, or is it just any 12 that they're doing, and that's a check mark?
Steve, could you? Great. So I believe that the survey tool includes 12 of 45 total practices. That's how I'm reading it.
Is it 45?
They have selected 12 to include in their survey.
Are there 12 that have been set aside for everyone to use for this purpose, or is it that there are 45 and each person reporting says, I'm going to pick, you know, my 12?
There's a group of 12 pre-selected for this survey, and it only evaluates those 12.
If you know what 12 those are, just if you have them, because
we'd have to look it up, but we can.
Okay.
Pending any getting any further information on these, do you want to just keep the ones that we had discussed previously, since it seems like we must have accepted them previously based on some agreement that they were important measures? There's only a handful. We talked about the medical home this morning.
Well, there's also on page 35 the CAPS clinician survey cultural competency item set. So which is designed for clinicians and group practices, which is usually the level that you measure a medical home at. So this measure is talking about a plan. So are we saying the plan is a medical home?
Are you asking about 1909? Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that's our health plan level one, is it?
1904.
I think 1904 asks the patient for their perception, whereas this other one asks the organization, the 1919. And in my experience, all the organizations check off that they're doing it. And so it's not a very robust tool, but they all say yes, 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 yes. Whereas the other, 1904, asks the patient's perception, which seems more powerful.
It would seem in the interest of harmonization that it would be more beneficial to ask the patient about the same 12 prioritized items as the plan facilities being asked about, wouldn't it?
In my recollection, the items are different. The ones for the organization tend to be about do they have processes in place, I mean, things that the patient would not respond to. Do you have a policy? Do you do an in-service? That kind of thing. So the other is more what happened in the interaction with the patient and provider.
And most providers will say that they have all these processes in place. The question of whether those are ever received by a patient is another matter altogether.
The gap in between the patient experience and the provider being reported, I mean, whether they actually receive it, is that a measurement gap?
I think it is in terms of the quality of the tools are very poor in actually getting at what we want, which is cultural competency. So I think that's an area needing improvement.
So the question is, do you want to keep them in their gapish state or do you want to drop either one of them?
Because there's nothing else, I think we should keep them and highlight the importance of them.
Yeah, again, I think it comes back to those concepts that we will so much want to stress.
Right.
Okay. So we're talking about 1919, right? But that's measured at the hospital acute care facility level. So what we're saying is we want measures of cultural competency that measure the hospital.
I think what we've been saying all along the last couple of days is we want broad measures of cultural competency, and we're limited by what's available. This one seems to be limited by setting and many others.
So I guess my fundamental question is, do we want to measure cultural competency from the perception of the consumer, and did they receive cultural competency care, or do we want to measure cultural competency from what a provider or a plan says they do or they don't do? And if we want to do the former, then we don't want 1919, we just want 1904. And maybe we want measures like 1904 applied to a broader set of settings.
I think as limited as it is, 1919 asks if there is structure in place that theoretically provides for it. So it's a structural measure, and I think that is important. Is there someone on your board? Do you have a policy about it? So to me, it's not a great measure because you can check off yes, but I still think we need a measure.
We have the Okay, there's a whole weighting scheme about these. The first is preferred practice 3, ensure that a commitment to culturally competent care is reflected in the vision, goals, and mission of the organization and couple this with an actionable plan. Preferred practice 4, implement strategies to recruit, retain, and promote at all levels of the organization a diverse leadership that reflects the demographic characteristics of the service area. Preferred practice 5, ensure that the necessary fiscal and human resources, tools, skills, and knowledge to support and improve culturally competent policies and practices in the organization are available.
Number 8 is integrate into the organizational strategic plan clear goals, policies, operational procedures, and in management accountability and oversight mechanisms to provide culturally competent services. 10, implement reward and recognition programs to recognize specific individuals, initiatives, and programs within the organization that promote cultural competency. I can keep going, but I think you have the flavor, but I will. Number 12, offer and provide language access resources in the patient's primary written and spoken language at no cost, at all points of contact, and in a timely manner during all hours of operation.
That's good.
Mm-hmm. And provide both verbal offers and written notices informing patients of their right to receive language assistance services free of charge. 23 is develop and implement a comprehensive care plan that addresses cultural concerns. 30, implement training that builds a workforce that is able to address the cultural needs of patients and provide appropriate and effective services as required by federal, state, and local laws, regulations, and organizational policies. 32, collaborate with the community to implement programs with clinical and outreach components to address culturally diverse populations, health disparities, and equity in the community. 37, ensure that, at a minimum, data on an individual patient's race and ethnicity using the OMB categories as modified by HRET, and primary written and spoken language are collected in health records and integrated into the organization's management information systems. Periodically update the language information.
Nicely concrete.
Apply a quality improvement framework to improve cultural competency and discover and eliminate disparities in care using the race, ethnicity, and primary written and spoken language information collected by the institution. And finally, number 43 is assess and improve patient and family-centered communication on an ongoing basis.
I kind of feel like there's enough there, right? Do you feel like that? By the time we got halfway through, I felt like, okay, there's enough there to say yes.
They only have to pick 12 of those.
Those are the 12 of 43 that are of 45 that are measured by this measure.
Oh, okay.
There are additional practices that are in this MQF report that are not evaluated.
So but now, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if I could mention, some of these are also plan requirements, like in marketing, and they will be audited on it. So there are other places where some of these 12 are, you know, will come up where they're held to it.
Alrighty. I kind of feel like we're good to go then on the structural ones, unless Sean has a strong disagreement.
Disagreement. Just a question about how, again, as other, there is some incompleteness to that that thing around, particularly around the fact that, you know, there's a whole world of culturally specific healing systems that we don't tend to talk about when we talk about cultural competency. We basically want to learn enough about the other culture so that they accept our biomedical model, you know, but we don't learn enough about them, the world of healing that exists and that is embedded in their particular perspective that would ideally be addressed and incorporated and respected. So that's another piece. So as things develop, we can get that into the pipeline, right?
Also, I guess I would ask if you could, like, add that to our, like, reading stack. Mm-hmm. If there's things that as we go through the other long list of the things that weren't in the measure that you look at and say, whoa, this is one that would have been really valuable to include in the measure, then we could send that message to, you know, it's like you outlined these 100 things. How come you only picked those 12 or whatever? Okay. Yeah. Deb?
So this category is structural measures. And so I'd like to say I think there's a gap. I think there needs to be a structural measure that says, can the plan audit that the person got all the services in the care plan?
Okie doke. Anything else that is in terms of, like, making sure it gets on the record before we move on to the next section of the agenda in terms of big old, I have this many gaps just from today, but in case there's any that you want to reinforce. Okay, we're going to take a break then at this point. We'll reconvene at 10 to 2, and we are running a little ahead of schedule. You'll be happy to know. Coming back.
So congratulations on being very efficient in reviewing measures for the family. We did manage to trim down the group, but we're still slightly over 80 measures. So I think that we will incorporate this into a follow-up exercise where we can show you what those 80 measures are in a list. You can take a little bit more time with it. We'll probably ask you to vote off your 10 least favorite measures, you know, if you're really forced, and see what kind of patterns emerge from that forced prioritization. Just to give you some overall rough statistics on what we were able to eyeball out of the spreadsheet, across our 5 high-leverage opportunity areas, we now have 10 measures tagged to quality of life, 37 for care coordination and safety, 20 for screening and assessment, about 15 for mental health and substance use, and about 5 for structural. Absolutely. And don't, like, hold me to them forever, but 10, quality of life, 37, care coordination and safety, 20, screening and assessment, 15, mental health, substance use, and 5, structural. It's not a surprising distribution to me, given that a lot of the quality of life concepts this group wants to measure are still gap areas. We've placed a large emphasis on care coordination and safety. There's many types of things to screen and assess, so that explains the number there. We just had such a detailed conversation about mental health and substance disorders. We have a pretty healthy number in that category, and structural has always been a little bit of a straggler in the framework in terms of the volume of measures. Samantha, did you have a comment?
I was just going to ask, when we vote off, mm-hmm. Would you be able to maybe help flag which measures could roll into a composite, and then also tell us, like you have already in the column, like which ones are specified mm-hmm. That already exist, and then also and then for the structural measures, again, just if we didn't have any that were HIT related, then if I don't know if we revisit that or how we operationalize that.
Okay.
That's it.
Deb?
I don't know where you put this, but it might be helpful to say, following up on Samantha's comment about the E specifications, around these populations, there's a lot of things that aren't in electronic health records because of the way that we're currently sort of moving that process along, like home health is excluded, nursing home is excluded, home and community-based service providers are excluded, the behavioral health providers are excluded with the exception of the psychiatrist, and then there's all kinds of issues in a way it just gets complicated.
I just wanted to follow up with Deb. So I'm on the ONC Policy Committee Consumer Empowerment Work Group. And stage 3, we really are trying to link to all these community providers, behavioral health community and community nonprofits, even though they don't have electronic health records yet, but we're trying to use meaningful use stage 3 as the vehicle to pull them into the electronic world. So I don't know if that'll get through the decision-making process.
That's really good, and that's helpful. But until we can link what the home health agency does with people who are discharged from the hospital to the rest of the health care system, or until we can link behavioral health, I just think there's an issue.
Well, to that point, I wasn't saying we should vote off measures that aren't specified. I think it helps further the discussion around those issues, so highlighting that.
There's a few other characteristics we've been tracking, and I'll just run through those, too. We now have 7 composite measures in the family, 24 outcome measures, 49 process, 2 to 5 structural, depending on the tagging scheme. 5 patient experience measures, and 14 that are disparity sensitive. Yep. We counted 7 composites, 24 outcomes, 49 process measures, and 2 structures. Those are mutually exclusive. Other factors which overlap are 5 of them relate to patient experience, and 14 are disparity sensitive. So those are just some of the ways we're going to be turning over our set and looking at it from many different dimensions. We can also include a calculation of the subgroups, as Clark asked for earlier, the levels of analysis, the care settings, just sort of look at our distribution of measures in a number of ways. Are there other data points you think you'll need to facilitate your decision-making, Clark?
Just that we're going to strive not to use patient in this group. I know
I can't take
anyone who's worked
in
medical has to use, but I think it's really an important message that we strive to use person, consumer, anything. But patient has such a paternalistic medical model overlay to it.
We'll hear your voice in our heads as we write. So we have 5 experience measures.
Sarah, can I add one quick thing, too, which is just that, for example, the 37 that are in the care coordination and safety bucket, I understand what you're saying, that we're going to break them down a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. I think one really useful way to break that 37 down would be to see, you know, are there 2 big chunks that are there just for the purpose of sort of proportionality to make sure that, you know, because as we've been talking about these in a sort of way that is abstracted from prioritization, mm-hmm. I could see us, you know, of the 37 having 20 that are all in some area that we really think is only 5% of the field, but so just that thought.
Yeah, we'll take a look at that.
I don't know how you could overlay this, but this issue was measures exist in some settings and not other settings, especially when it comes to it might exist at the clinician or hospital and not at the plan or vice versa, because I think that that's a growing issue with...
Yeah, if you're picturing our diagram of the many squares, we want to know how many of those are actually filled in for a topic and where the holes are if you line it up across care settings. That'll be an important illustration for us.
In the situation where a measure is a prerequisite, as we discussed earlier, to another measure, and it appears to be redundant, but it is prerequisite, how do you propose that we handle that? Because, again, when you look at them and you forget some of the discussion, you're going to say, well, this is repetition, there is redundant, so eliminate this, and you were, in fact, you're not eliminating anything. So how is that going to be handled?
We have just that one case of the 2 measures that have to be paired, and we would, I think, structure the survey so that you include both or you include neither. We'll sort of combine them within the assessment. Okay, so your participation in that exercise will be tremendously helpful to get this, you know, the last 10% of the way finished for this iteration, just to, you know, strengthen and hone the signal about what's important. Deb?
When you had our webinar, you talked about how the time frame for this work is a little bit different than the time we had before, and you talked about how the report to the department was more abbreviated and focus on more technical specifications, but based upon all of our conversation today, it also includes these discussions we've had around measure gaps as part of that, as opposed to we just recommend. So I'm trying to understand sort of what your vision is for the report today as opposed to when we did the webinar. Maybe that's...
Yeah, I think... it's very important for us to reach a firm consensus around the contents of the family, first and foremost, because it's a measure-focused deliverable. We've had a lot of gap discussion and a lot of, you know, notes for measure developers and implementers.
which have been captured pretty seamlessly through the hard work of Megan Amaru and Alexandra. So I think we'll be listening to the recording and the transcript to extract all of that. So instead of having a lot of narrative about those themes, you might just see it kind of plunked into a table more as bullets in a little bit more of an unrefined fashion for this, you know, temporary state that we're in. Since the web meeting, we have received a task order at NQF to continue this work for at least a base year of 12 months with possible option years after that. We're, like, just still in the process of responding to that, so it's definitely not set in stone, but it gives us the indication that this work will continue for, you know, longer than we had under the extension. And so things like a reprioritization of gaps that includes many of the concepts raised today could be a web meeting later this summer, and there will be other convenings to follow where we could delve into social determinants, some of the CAPS issues, nursing home metrics based off the MDS. There's probably a whole host of topics that this group would like to continue to explore, and, you know, CMS, HRSA, and others as well. So is that helpful? One of the elements we had in our template is that we'd like to look at the family against one existing measure set just to illustrate the alignment. We have some suggestions up on the slide in front of you. If one of these is seeming to be particularly helpful as an illustration, or if you have suggestions for others, we could have some discussion about that. Or if there's other comments about what's most important to emphasize now versus later. Clark?
I think this alignment would be really helpful. And just go through the chart, Joint Commission, because you have the 7 mental illness inpatient psychiatric hospital measures, mm-hmm. the 7 of our 87 are Joint Commission. So I think it would be helpful just to be able to see how our measures align with a longer list. But this is great. I think this would be really helpful.
So you'd like to see it by measure steward or?
Well, that would be helpful.
Okay.
I guess Medicaid is helpful with stewards.
Yeah, these are all programs or other sets. But it's not hard to, you know, filter the family to look for one factor, like is it a Joint Commission measure or is it an ambulatory care measure or is it the set, the other thing? Deb?
There is work going on in this area, but it sort of fits up on this list, and that is managed long-term care. So,
Steve?
Yeah, I wondered about also putting up against the PACE program quality criteria and the dual eligible SNP plan, special needs plan.
Amita, how would you feel about that?
Absolutely, but you know, we're still in the process of
developing our measures, but we can share with the staff.
Okay.
I can talk to
at more of a topical level than a measure-by-measure comparison.
Am I correct that the PACE measures and the dual-eligible SNP measures are also somewhat in evolution, or they're, mm-hmm. or maybe they're all changing, but maybe that we gradually see some convergence of these different...
Support all of the Medicare Advantage measures, and then they have a, you know, set of SNP-specific measures like structure and process and some model of care-related things, but, I mean, the Medicare Advantage are pretty standard. But I think it's a good idea to the extent that, I mean, we in the SNP community are always looking for ways to benchmark our performance as well, so to the extent that some of these dual measures we've been talking about
especially the dual eligible
crossover,
very, very helpful.
Yeah, so, but there's a very strong sense that the PACE measures will change,
There's a strong belief in that, and to support that, we are coming up with a common data set, so there's a lot of work being put into that effort. So.
Okay, so like MFP, Money Follows the Person, has sort of a kind of a quality management thing and some data collection. It might be worth looking at. So one thing that I don't see strongly in here is this the whole Olmsted perspective, you know, helping people get out of nursing homes and other institutions living in the community, specifically, you know, measures around that. And that's the whole point of MFP. And then the other one is, since somebody mentioned managed care, there's just guidance put out just yesterday by CMS on a whole bunch of standards, recommendations, and, you know, how much the implementation is a whole different question, but at least it's there to look at on for managed care, for managed long-term services and supports.
Lots of good ideas, Deb.
There's a whole lot of programs at CMS that have hospital readmission measures, and there's movement towards, you know, all-cause hospital readmission. I mean, that's the name of the measure. But then when you look at the details, the mental health and substance abuse population are excluded, and it seems like if we're trying to promote alignment, or do we need additional rehospitalization measures for the mental health and the substance abuse, or do we re-specify the existing measure and have it reported for a subpopulation? It just seems like if we're trying to go that way as a system.
That's a good recommendation. Thanks. That's a perfect segue. We'll come back to public comment. To think about really actionable recommendations like that, really crisp measure development needs, other sources you want us to look to for measures, topics you want this work group to consider potentially. We'll sort of take all that back. We want our latest round of findings to really keep the needs of the stakeholders in mind and, you know, speak to them. I think they're really hungry for guidance and your expertise in a lot of areas. So maybe we'll, I think we'd like to go around the table and actually, you know, call on you to share some parting thoughts as we're now close to the end of our agenda. We can take comment to give you all a minute to compose your thoughts, and then, you know, do a bit of a round robin. So on the phone, is there anyone that would like to make comment at this time?
To make a comment at this time, please press star 1.
Anyone in the room?
You know, I had to have one parting comment. Thank you all for allowing me to come. One thing that came up pretty frequently, and I threw a few into it too, is that of gaps in care, or measurement gaps, that is. And the issue that we run into as I started thinking about some of these is that NQS typically has used a standard of medical quality of care. It's a scientific version of how we go about measuring what's a gap. But then you had one out there about health plans. It is in no way going to be one that would be a measurable scientific type of gap, but it's there. We need to think in terms, too, of the social sciences and engineering sciences as other places to draw in measures that I think would help particularly with this group. So that's my one thought. Thank you.
Are there any comments from the phone?
There are no comments.
Thank you.
So again, here you can take any of these three questions or all three of them. Totally up to you how you want to tackle. And we're just going to start with Ruth and go around the table. Is this counterclockwise? Yes, counterclockwise. Ruth?
I think for number one, for HHS, I think it follows around the social determinants of health. And as they begin to think through projects and models of care and through their grant awarding processes, that they recognize that there are significant social determinants of health and that we need to measure them, that we could do to the extent that medicine can do everything right within its domain, we can still have poor health outcomes and poor and high costs of care if we don't begin to understand these social determinants of health and understand where they intersect and be able to measure that. And I think that would be then the same would apply for number two, for measure developers, that they need to move in that direction for end users of measures in the field. For them not to despair over the large number of metrics that are out there. Cheryl, do you want to have the prerogative of going last, or do you want to?
No, I'll go ahead and go now.
Okay. Yeah.
I think for HHS, the key messages would be the integration and coordination with the other measures that are all being developed at HHS, but that's a key priority for everyone involved in the quality world. For measure developers, I think for this group, I would highlight the need to be as specific as possible for measure developers on how to improve the measures. There are a lot of measures that we didn't see a lot, that we saw things that we wanted to comment on, but the degree that we can be very specific about what it is that would allow improvement and the way that we want it to be improved for that measure, I think the better for the end result. And then I guess an action item for the measure developer is for them to start moving forward with those. And then for end users, to make sure that what they're using is based on the criteria of what's meaningful as opposed to what's measurable easily.
Thanks, Valerie.
I think my first couple of comments would be appropriate both for HHS and for the measure developers. And I'm picking up on what has already been said a little bit, but I think the need for alignment across measurement sets is tremendously important. And since we're talking about a dual population, 90% of SNP enrollees are dual, and we have this tremendous movement on the front of integration of Medicare and Medicaid that have to follow a lot of the SNP rules like model of care. It's tremendously important to line up the model of care requirements with both the structure and process measures and the plan rating measures. And that hasn't happened yet. And we've had a number of conversations about this. SNP Alliance has submitted a lot of comments. And I just think it's really important, especially as we're within this group developing yet another set of dual measures, to make sure that we have alignment between model of care, Medicare Advantage requirements, Medicaid, and any new dual measures that come out of this. I agree with what Ruth said, too, that it just seems like in the last 6 months within the SNP Alliance, there's a tremendous amount of discussion going on about social determinants and the impact of social determinants on health, the ability of a plan to score well because of those determinants, and also the relationship between social determinants and services needed and payment, and then the impact on quality at the end there. Because if you can't provide the kind of services that are needed because they aren't accounted for in the payment system or in the benefit system, and it's going to affect quality on the other end. So we really need to ramp up this discussion, and I'm really excited to hear that Ruth has been raising that issue in Trenton. Parsimony to me goes along a little bit with the alignment issue. We've spent a lot of time looking at specific Medicare Advantage requirements by SNP type, whether it's a dual, a C-SNP, or an institutional SNP. In some cases, I think, and this might be we need to work more with the measure developers to maybe make some modifications to some of the specifications, because just for example, if you take the breast cancer screening and the colorectal cancer screening, for nursing home the nursing home populations, primarily they aren't going to be the most important measure. And so instead of plans having to screen out of those and prove that they're not the appropriate measure, couldn't we have some different specs if we could get, you know, a little bit more specific? On the self-report issues that I think Sarah was sort of referencing when she was talking about some of the gap measurement, I was kind of hoped, I guess I was under the impression that Lisa Patton was going to be speaking at this meeting, and I must have just misunderstood on the April 30th call, but I still feel like we really haven't heard how to address this issue of self-report measures for people that have mental illness, cognitive impairment, you know, some behavioral health issues. And I think I was hoping maybe to get some ideas from SAMHSA about that, because we don't know what the answer is. We just have the concern about data validity and reliability, and we've been talking about it. I know we've talked to PACE about it. There are a number of organizations out there that are concerned about it, and I just don't know the route to get there and what the solution is. And maybe for the end users, I think maybe we just need to figure out, do a better job of making some recommendations to the measurement developers and HHS, and maybe working more closely with the researchers, because I feel that this is really a critical issue that needs to be addressed, and I don't see it being addressed, and I'm not sure how to make that happen.
It's very helpful. Samantha.
So I would just concur with the comments around measure parsimony and alignment. At HRSA, we're very focused on, again, identifying the measures that matter most across the Bureau and offices and the different grantee programs in an effort also to decrease grantee reporting burden and in support of the national quality strategy that is supportive of alignment and parsimony among all the other principles and aims of the triple aim and the national quality strategy. I would concur with the comments around the social determinants and look forward to the future work of this group in that area, and would add that clearly at HRSA, it's an issue that, you know, frankly, it's been part of our mission and our goals, and our health centers have reimbursed for supportive services around transportation and other issues historically. So we're very in tune and supportive on those areas and look forward to future collaboration on that front. And then last but not least, for end users and measures of the field. So I've given this a lot of thought, particularly as it relates to NQF strategic plan that, came out a year ago maybe? I can't remember. But I think when we started, there wasn't the strategic plan in place that talked about the feedback loops per se. And then we saw that come out maybe when we were after year one of the MAP and the duals. And so I think that's significant because around this table, we have national stakeholders and experts, and oftentimes the voices of what's happening in the communities. But I'd encourage NQF to think through how do you get that direct community feedback. And so at HRSA, I had envisioned that could be facilitated through us, but I don't think it needs to be facilitated through the federal level at all. I think that could happen directly from the community to NQF. And you may get kind of a different perspective, a different response if it's not kind of filtered through a federal level, even though we've worked with some on some fronts to encourage different groups to talk about the NQS and know that their feedback is welcome and solicited through us or directly to AHRQ. And so I think to the extent that the future products of this group not only reflect the stakeholders and the public comments, but really have some examples around the measure challenges and the balances and what it means at the community level with consumer perspectives especially, that would be really kind of showing a rich development in some of the products from, you know, when we started before that strategic plan was in place. So really focusing on operationalizing that feedback loop, as I know you have, as delineated by some of the goals in the strategic plan. Thank you.
Thanks, Gail. So I'm always struck at the end of these meetings how many measures we have, and then I'm always discouraged by the time we identify gaps and limitations and modifications of how totally inadequate they are for what we want to accomplish. So my key message would be also for the measure developers, and that is the real importance on quality of life. I think we're so focused on healthcare treatment that we're missing the real game here. And so encouraging measures looking at patient goals, patient autonomy, living environment, community, social support, that may not be as important to the more physical health sector, but it often is, but it's critically important to our population. And I think we have yet to find adequate measures for those. For the end measures, for the end users of measures in the field, I'm always reminded of garbage in and garbage out. And since I know many of the folks who are doing these measures, I know they're often done in a very cursory, haphazard, let's get this form out of the way. And, you know, maybe we even need some standards about how you do the measurements, because you're only as good as the data you collect.
I think we talked about, you know, accountability and who's accountable at what environment, et cetera. And needless to say, all of us who are involved in healthcare delivery are all accountable in trying to achieve the end goal that we want to achieve for that person, consumer, patient. At the same time, though, I think it is critical to recognize that you can do everything that you can possibly do, even under the most ideal conditions, and yet your results may not yield what you expect, because the receiver, in this case the consumer, is not particularly partnering with what you are trying to do. And so as it relates to accountability, empowerment, and ownership of one's health, ownership of one's quality of life, ownership of one's well-being, it seems to me that there's got to be something that we can get help on in terms of how do we put some of that accountability that comes along with the empowerment on the consumer person so that we are all partnering in this together. So that to me is key. As it relates to the measure developers, I think that, you know, I think depending on who these developers are, from what perspective they're coming from, and we saw that today in some of the exclusions, I think it is critical for us to recognize that certain exclusions create a basis for invalidation of some of the measurements and also the impact of what we suspect the results are. So I think it is critical to recognize that and ensure that in the best attempts to narrow the application of a particular measure to a specific group, we don't invalidate by that narrowing of the focus for that measure. And lastly, as it relates to end users, I think in the field, everybody, and I'm a believer in this, that everybody wants to do the right thing and wants to provide the best care to that person, to that consumer, and the best experience. At the same time, in the process of doing that, and you want to be measured and compared, as also to see the impact of your result, you want to have something that is objective, that is measurable. And I think in terms of what we have today, as it relates to that experience of the consumer, we don't have that objectivity that will make everybody more comfortable in terms of their results, or in terms of even applying more resources to improve something that they are not quite good at.
Thanks. Clark.
Thanks. I'd like to reinforce five or six ideas, but a couple of them give a slightly different orientation to them of things that are important. So on Ruth's points about social determinants, I think that's something we really need to focus on, and just to remind people again, the Affordable Care Act defines disability as a disparate population, and so we need to better focus on social determinants, we need to better focus on disparities, and we need to remember that disability is part of the disparity dynamics faced in our society. I wanted to repeat a previous discussion. Deb and Sean made the point about Medicaid managed care, and CMS has 10 essential elements now, and that those 10 essential elements might be another scheme to classify all of our measures and our gaps. Consumers all over the country who are dependent on the system now are scared to death of any change, but managed care is like the big scary. And so we have to be aware of that and do whatever we can to make that system work and make it work in terms of quality. I would like to see this group recommend a significant federal investment in the development of quality measures in the gap areas. I work on SAMHSA Wellness Campaign Steering Committee. We are recommending the SAMHSA Administrator three areas of investment in gap areas, consistent with the discussion we've had the last 2 days. And I know NIDR, the National Institute of Disability Rehabilitation and Research, which funds the National Core Indicators Project, is also looking at an era of discretionary money going down, but they're looking at the importance of investing in gap development measures. So it would be nice for us to do that. When we talk about parsimony, I actually never knew what parsimony was till I came here a year ago, and now I guess I know what it is. But I guess my take is that the garbage in, garbage out comment Gail made. A lot of these measures have no real meaning to people in their daily life and how the system responds to help them in their daily life. And so I'm happy to replace a lot of measures, but we need to think through carefully to make sure each measure has meaning to an individual person. And that's hard to do, but I think that's our burden, is to do that. Valerie's point about self-report of people with serious and persistent mental illness, I mentioned yesterday, and I mention at every meeting, there are 4 state public mental health systems that finance independent consumer and family monitoring teams. Massachusetts does it through the Medicaid Managed Care Company. Maryland, Pennsylvania, parts of Pennsylvania and parts of Wisconsin do it through their public mental health system. But these are ways of having the direct consumer and peers evaluate the system. And Massachusetts was started in 1999. Philadelphia was started in 1999. So we have a few of these programs been around over a decade. And SAMHSA is investing a lot of money in peer wellness specialists. These are people who have a history of mental illness who are now employed by the system as peers to help their fellow peers develop wellness strategies. And there's a whole network of peer wellness specialists around the country. We have 6 Medicaid programs that actually finance peer wellness specialists, people with mental illness, as providers in the Medicaid network. And we have a number of managed care organizations like Optimum, that Dr. Rhonda Robinson Beal on our group is the medical director of, that finances through managed care arrangements peer wellness specialists. So there's a lot of things happening. It's just a matter of figuring out where and who and filling the gap. So those are some ideas from that end that I wanted to react to.
Gwen? So I would just say to measure developers that, and I know because we're missing a lot of measures, to encourage measure developers
around the world, or, you know, to develop measures. And when they do so, to think about outcomes, they're the harder measures to develop and to think and to measure, and that they're the more important ones. And to also think about being patient-centered, which goes around quality of life and all of these things, which I think a lot of the measures are more focused on the easy to measure, you know, how many people are getting whatever service. And so to encourage more measure developers to develop measures in around the gap areas. And for the end users, for us and for anybody, you know, endorsing measures, that if it's not, if it's an okay measure and it meets criteria, well, fine. But if it's not really answering the question or the need that we really have, and we're just saying, well, it's the best we have, so okay, but that may be putting, you know, undue burden on end users if we're just saying, well, it's what we have, so we'll take it.
Oh, that'll help us with that next exercise of the you should make sure and capture that question. Is this just going to add burden by substituting a crummy measure because it has the right couple of concepts in it? Amita.
Yeah, sure. So the first comment for both HHS and measure developers is we really are in a situation where everything is evolving so fast. So, yes, you know, we do want to have some measures that, you know, are steady from year to year so we can measure how we are doing. But nonetheless, you know, there is this challenge of constantly evolving new measures as our understanding of what works and what doesn't work changes, as technology changes, as the awareness in the population changes about the changes they need to bring to their lifestyles. So I think there's this constant balancing act which should be recognized. The message for end users of the measures is that there's a lot of responsibility on you. It seems like the data work is done, the measures are developed, and the outcomes are presented to whoever is reading the report. Well, question the results you get. If your results look to be too good for what you know your program is capable of doing, then maybe they are too good. Delve a little bit behind the surface to see if your data capture is adequate. And I'm speaking this from a data perspective. And somebody made the comment of garbage in and garbage out, and I'm very, very close to that and very, very familiar with that. Data developers can produce 100% results, which obviously, you know, as we all know, cannot be true in every instance. The other question for the measure users is, to what end are you going to use these results? Are you looking for some trend changes year over year? Are you looking at improvements? Have you set some targets in place which would speak to changing your processes and how you go about measuring? Are you looking at the results and analyzing and seeing if they're statistically significant? I know people want to narrow down the measures to disease specific. So, you know, you need to look at things. Is your population size big enough to give you results that are valid? So I think a big onus, a big responsibility lies with the end user.
Okay, Sean?
Okay, I agree with everybody. Great. And on the social determinants, I just think it's worth pointing out, like, there's a huge overlap congruence with quality of life. I think that as we look at quality of life around people with disabilities and people who are aging, using person-centered planning and thinking to help that get developed, understood, documented, and acted on through services, in that will necessarily be discussions around what we were calling social determinants. You'll have to talk about education level, employment. I mean, that comes up, food security, a whole list of all the stuff that is included in social determinants has some bearing in quality of life that could be expressed at the individual level. And a lot of the measure, and then also at the larger level, at the community level, state level, et cetera. And a lot of stuff could be captured and is captured through, you know, administrative data sets that we already have. I think that, so those two things, I think, would go hand in hand and need to be addressed, I think, together. And as we know, most of the populations we're talking about are particularly vulnerable on both aspects of quality of life and social determinants. That there needs to be outcome measures based, I've talked about this enough, I guess, but outcome measures based on quality of life. You know, that we need to figure out, start to think about ways to measure whether a person's self-defined quality of life has improved as a result of these services. That's where all of it is. I mean, that's what HCBS is supposed to be about, and we can't say much about that right now, unfortunately. I think that there's some potential, there might be worth looking at analyzing the measures and as they're developed through the lens of Olmsted. I think there's a number of measures that address Olmsted in some way, maybe not directly, but certainly support the idea of helping people stay in communities, stay out of institutions, leave institutions, be diverted from institutional settings, et cetera, which is what the Olmsted thing really is about. And so that would be great to have as much of that focus, since that is a Supreme Court decision. It's a big deal. It's, you know, something that is always getting raised. What can we say? This is maybe a thing for HHS to do, frankly. And another thing for HHS, I'll go back and advocate that somebody from ACL come to this thing regularly. And that also service array, I think, came up. I think a few times. I think that's really important. There are, for instance, on the community-based side, there are, for mental health, there's what's the employment rate, under 10% maybe at best. There's a service out there that's highly researched. I mean, umpteen, controlled experiments, randomized controlled experiments on it that shows great individual placement support, supported employment. That should be available to everybody. It's only available, according to Sansa statistics, of like 2% of the people that could use it. Got a 10% employment rate. That thing, if that service applied, gets people up to around a 40% range. You know, there's a huge disparity there. Why not measure it? Pay attention to it. Figure out ways to finance it and support it. That's just one example. There's lots of them. So there's a whole question of service around HCBS for all these different groups that would help support quality of life and all the social determinants issues. I think there's a question around survey and admin data collection, that needs to be looked at. I mean, surveys are expensive. There's all kinds of, I'm not saying surveys are bad, but they are expensive to do. They aren't easily scalable. There's a time lag, You can't do the dive in and really do the analysis that you could do if you had collected data administratively. And that if we look toward that as a data collection as a sort of a more effective thing to review in our measure discussions, that might be helpful. And that lends itself to the last thing on my list, which goes to both HHS and end users, which is the question of the process of using data in the first place. What are we doing all this for? Collecting all this measure so we can improve things. We know things aren't working right. We know there's never 100, you never had 100% of anything. So let's just acknowledge that. We're collecting data so that we can do CQI, the PDS is planned to do study act cycles. I mean, this is the point of all this. So that would go to HHS to support, and I guess for anybody else, in the plan, to use this data in ways to help improve things continuously. And that, again, points on a lot of that points to use of admin data as well, so you can really dig in and find places that are important to look at. And I would also suggest to end users, not just end users of this data, but end users generally, do your own research, do action research, get involved, at your level, wherever you are, if you're a provider, do some stuff, do study act cycles, and that might lead to some things that we don't know about yet, that's part of the discussion. So, thanks.
Thanks. Leonardo?
Thanks. So I have 4 points. The first one is one that I've raised before, but not in the last 2 days, so, which is just that, we've been talking a lot about the diseases of high prevalence with duals, but what defines duals is actually a coverage thing. And so my sort of threshold question is always, when we design new systems for duals, do they have access to everything they need? Because if they don't, they're no better off than they were in fee-for-service. That's something that I think is hard to measure if you just take the approach of a say transactional visit to some provider and say, yeah, he or she got really good service from, you know, the cardiac specialist they saw. But that doesn't really tell you if their healthcare needs are being met more broadly, which is why I think the care coordination type stuff is really important. Second point is just to back everything Gail said about quality of life, which I think is really important. And, you know, I mentioned earlier community integration, and I think we saw some evidence yesterday from Beth's slides about how if you can address some of those things, so much more is positive going to happen. The more contact points people have with the system and with the community, the easier it is to take care of them. The third thing I think that we've done and maybe not thought enough about is we've made this shift from core set to family, which I get the framework. I think we will have to think more about what that means in terms of instructions we give to Cheryl, right? If instead of giving her 10 core measures, we give her 40 that are family, that I think is a very different thing. And I think we're going to have to think more about prioritizing that list, which, as you know, I like to harp on prioritization, but I think we all know that there are some real low-hanging fruit out there with this population in terms of things that we could immediately make an impact on, so I don't want to miss those things. And fourth and finally, speaking of burden, another point that I've made before, I know it's important to think about burden, so I'm not saying it's not a factor, but we have in the next 5 years, we're going to add, 17 million people to Medicaid. We're going to add another 17 million through the exchanges. We are shifting to managed care in all of these areas, and we have, an unprecedented rollout of EHR technology requirements, et cetera. So we're in the window that's going to set the default that is in existence for the 20 years after that. So, if we take an extremely incremental approach right now, and then 5 years from now we say, we've got a much better way of doing something, people are going to come back to us and say, but we rolled out this whole EHR system and it doesn't have this capability that you're now asking us to do. So while I'm sensitive to burden, I'm more sensitive to the fact that this is the moment to get it right, and so if given a choice between burden and getting it right, I'm always going to err on the side of getting it right.
Sally.
Okay, thanks. sorry. Something that I have mentioned, I think, from the first time we met, and continue to hit on this note. I am concerned about the lack of attention to workforce in any measures in any meaningful way. We know that this is, there continues to be a shortage in every state and nationally with the direct care workforce because of trends, incentives moving people into the community as well as demographic changes with aging. This is only going to be exacerbated, so it's something we have to do better on. And even within the workforce that does exist, inadequate though it may be, in terms of capacity overall, there is still a lot of turnover and churn in that workforce. And we do know from examining on the patient side that does impact quality of life from the patient perspective, as well as impact outcomes on the medical side of it as well. So that's something that we should figure out more about what's not there, what's not happening that should be, and to measure for it. There are some measures here that we do talk about support for caregivers, but that's in the volunteer and family sector when we use the term caregiver. It's not in the paid workforce. But that's, it's just really important. And I would say if we are, I hope we do really focus on developing some measures there, but any that we do measure would develop would be incomplete if they don't start with actually talking to workers to, you know, interview, and so they're on better experience. And to that end, in terms of something to pass along for measure developers, work that the Paraprofessional Healthcare Institute, PHI, has done, as well as Direct Care Alliance, in terms of surveying workers, would be very useful. And so I really commend that work, and I hope that we can do better about this, because within the next 5 to 10 years, nationally, we have to do better in this area. So this is one, you know, one place that we could really do some good by developing some measures.
Thanks, Sally. Deb?
I feel like I've spoken so much in the last 2 days, but first I would like to thank all of you, because I always learn so much, and take it back to the kinds of things that are going on. But I'm also encouraged by how many things I know are going on that people have mentioned, and at least we're moving in the right direction. And so I want to thank all of you for your continued participation. Since I'm HHS, it's hard to say what would I recommend to HHS, so I'm going to pick on Cheryl. Sorry, Cheryl. I know that part of all of the work around the duals and all of the new models of care that are rolling out of CMMI are valuations. You know, there's a whole rapid set of evaluation. But I think there's also a need for really deep evaluations, because I think you could be at the cutting edge of where things need to go. And I wouldn't want to lose that opportunity. And so one that came to me the other day was this whole issue around an electronic health record and timely communications, and how it's, well, in reality, it's built upon personal communications, which isn't at all what we want. And so how did those plans operationalize that quickly? And that level of detail, I'm not sure, will come out of the evaluations, but I think that kind of detail would inform things like what ONC is doing, what the EHR systems are doing, and so sort of help. It's just like one example that came to mind, the whole area of how you do a comprehensive assessment and what should be included and what shouldn't be included and when do you do it is another example in that area that you probably have to get really deep and link it to outcomes, and I'm not sure that that deepness would necessarily be covered. I guess the other thing is, we've identified a lot of gaps, and I know that Sarah and Alice have talked about, well, our next step down the line. It would be really helpful for you all to say, if there's 4 things you do, do these 4. And I know that you'll all say different 4, but if we could take all of the 4 and line on them, well, 3/4 of the people say do this one, it's easier for us to get money and resources to push it forward. So, again, thank you.
Thanks. Juliana? All right. So, just to counteract Leonardo, I just the burden, I have to go back to the burden. So to HHS, I guess, just looking at physician offices, if, for example, you have meaningful use, you have PQRS, and now we're looking at medical home. Just for example, just anecdotally in Utah, we're working with just a pilot of 6 clinics, independent clinics, trying to have them look at medical home, and they take, 8 to 10 different health plans who all are requiring something different. So if we are really expecting better care, lower cost, we have to consider the burden that places on those individual providers that makes it almost impossible for them to redesign the way they deliver care, because they look at those outstanding requirements and continue to do business as usual. So there is a balance between doing the right thing and considering burden. And then,
this may seem obvious, but to measure developers, I just want to say, you know, pay very close attention to those gaps with the caveat to what Cheryl said earlier. Make it meaningful, because if it's not meaningful, it just becomes burden, and then people really look at gaining the measure if it's not meaningful to them. And then finally, working with providers on quality improvement projects for I don't know how many years since I was, I tell people since I was 12, since it's been, I think, 13 years. So I'm lying about my age. Providers feel very victimized, and you hear the complaints a lot, but you don't see a lot of action. So to providers, I would say, come to the table with a solution. Tell us, you know, quality measurement isn't going away. How can it be better? How can it be meaningful? And how can we use it to drive change in the system?
Thanks.
Well, I'll also say that I learned a lot from each of these get-togethers, that's for sure, and preparing for the meeting. What our work group's key message is, I would, you know, really take it back. This meeting got more in the weeds, I think, than any of our prior gatherings, and I would just take us back to the vision. I was even going to read it. In order to promote a system that's both sustainable and person and family-centered, individuals eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid should have timely access to appropriate, coordinated health care services and community resources that enable them to attain or maintain personal health goals. And then we've talked around a lot of measures that don't get there. And to be sure that the HHS doesn't say, well, because we maybe have a measure in that general area that cultural competence or these others, doesn't mean that we got it covered. And so I think, you know, going back to and many of the measures we have are, I would say, are maybe placeholders, you know. So we want to continue to go back to that individualized assessment and care plan and implementation of that care plan over time. And the and then any other evidence-based processes of care that we know will improve outcomes consistent with the vision. For the measure developers, I think it's really looking at not taking you've got a measure for this, but again go back to what are the measures that we've maybe started at, but what can we improve upon? What are the gaps in the high priority areas, and addressing those? And I had a suggestion potentially for this prioritization, and maybe we come up with a nuclear family, and an extended, you know, compared to the extended family. But I think that point around if we end up with 80, I think what I heard we have. That may or may not be so helpful, and I really like the point about, if there were five things that a health plan or a health system or would do, if there was nothing else that they, you know, were able to accomplish, what would they be? And helping to drive that forward. For end users and the measure, this is where I think we need constant feedback on what needs to be measured, what's important, and then how to better measure it and more efficiently. So you need that constant feedback and ideas as to, how do we do it better and how could we measure that in an efficient manner. So, thank you.
Thank you so much, all of you. I'm scribbling notes, too. I can't help myself. I'm kind of, as you all were talking, I was thinking about this follow-up exercise. We talked about having a follow-up exercise that was just identifying things that you could live without. When we first put together this slide, we talked about ranking measures, and I'm kind of now coming up with, like, clusters of criteria, so I just want to get a sense of whether this makes sense to you guys. So instead of voting for, like, here's the 10 that I don't want in, what if, and then this would make it maybe a harder exercise for you, but maybe not, take each one of the measures and rate them 1, 2, 3, 4. And so, like, the one level measures would be, these are the nuclear family measures. You know, these are the measures that they're ready to use right now. They should be in the starter set. They're priority topics that we've talked about. They meet all the criteria. So you would rate that a number one. Number two would be, here's a good measure, but it has one or two limitations. Like, either it's restricted to only one particular setting of care, or it's restricted to a particular age group that doesn't make us happy because it eliminates younger people, or it eliminates older people, or whatever. So that, but they still meet the criteria. So the number two level measures still meet our criteria. They still seem important. Then when you get down to three, it's a good measure, but it would need a major revision. So those would be the measures that we've said, like, we love this concept, but we need to rewrite the measure for it to work, and it wouldn't be worth the burden to say this ought to be in the nuclear family. And then you'd rate number four, the number four is the absolutely get rid of measures. So you might not be able to come up with 10 that are number four. Those are the ones that, you know, they're not important, they're a crummy measure, they don't meet our criteria, whatever. But so you might have just a handful, you know, three or four number four rated, but you might have like 20 that are number three. I don't know. But maybe does that help to have it like a 1, 2, 3, 4 instead of like get rid of these 10? Okay, good. Then I thought also in our follow-up we could ask for the one most important gap. I know that would be hard for most of you to say one most important gap, but it could be a concept like quality of life, or, you know, it could be like a big gap, but just one gap. And then you would need to let Sarah know between now and when the survey comes out if you need more detail for any of the measures. So, like, you know, the one that I remember, the medical home measure, it's like, how are you going to rate that? You just don't have enough information. But if there's other measures like that that you would need more information before you could rate them, you could let Sarah know, unless you know right off the top of your head already. Samantha?
Yeah, I would just ask Sarah, when you put is it like a Survey Monkey? Is that how you're going to do it, probably? So if you if you're putting that online, you probably can't include as much detail, but maybe there's like a supplementary attachment, because what I'd like to do is if you could create a survey so it stands alone, because what I would do is solicit input from colleagues who weren't here, so they're not privy to all this discussion, and I can't relay 2 days of, you know, so to the extent that it could be as much of a standalone, cohesive document, so I could get input from other colleagues, that would be helpful.
Okay. Yeah,
we've
already posted a number of resources that have been shared during the meeting to the SharePoint site where you've got the meeting materials. So the SNP Alliance paper about social determinants and bias in the STAR ratings, Steve shared some specifications for care of older adult measures. We can put Alice's New Yorker article up there if we can get access to it. And so we'll just have that central repository for as much as you want to dig in. We can put up more things about the medical home, that cultural competence structural measure. And Clark, do you have an additional suggestion?
No, it's a question. And so of the 87 measures, there are 20 I don't really know anything about and depend on others. And so I feel uncomfortable voting on a measure where at the meeting I would look at Steve's and rely on his judgment. And I think maybe on some disability and mental illness, some people might, you know, look to me. So I don't, can we opt out and just
have
a category
or
that
a choice for each measure?
We're not,
have a,
we're not,
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
When would you be sending out the list to us?
Our goal would probably be Monday.
Monday is the 27th.
Oh, Monday's Memorial Day. Sorry, we're not sending it on Monday.
because that really,
you want to be able to plan
for everybody else, but I'm traveling and I have other meetings. That really, the window is very narrow.
We can look at making a due date in early June. We'd want to give you at least a week. So a little bit of the onus is on us to get this processed as fast as we can. We could probably get that as long as 10 days, but again,
we need to be writing up the results quickly, so you'll have to work with us on that.
And I would just urge, and I think it's what Alice intended in her breakout of sort of 1, 2, 3, 4, but we have a way of being really clear about distinguishing between something that is good to go but might not be that important a measure and something that is really important but not quite good to go, because what I wouldn't want is for this to, for somebody to look at this and say, oh, he rated these four number one, let's do that, when in fact, those might be not be the top ones for me. So that, I think just that needs to be really clear in this process.
Two comments. Please do three gaps. The reason is because, we'll end up with a list of, two people said this and three people said this, and from a point of view of pushing inside, it's just more helpful to say, well, 3/4 of the people rated this in their top three. And so that's why I say three. With respect to Leo's comment, which I think is excellent, I don't know the gory details of underlying Survey Monkey, but if it's possible to, have another category for every rating, and that way if you want to put it in a second category and say this needs to be expanded to, there's a way to do that. So I just give that, if you want to capture why someone put it in a 2 rather than a 1, given we have already captured a lot of that, I don't know, maybe you don't want to revisit all of that, but so just something to think.
Be a mandatory field for those of you who are feeling the panic set in.
Right.
Would you like to have us provide you the laundry list of gaps that we've captured, or would you like to generate those on your own?
No.
Okay.
Okie doke.
Alice, could we also maybe have people list their top 3 measures? If you had to pick 3 of them, because we really have to get towards which ones. We've got the ones that are doable, but are those the right ones? So something about, maybe 5, but again, really trying to force people to think about, I can live without everything else, but I can't live without these. That would be tremendously helpful to us. And that'll help us just with, should we spend a lot of energy on the ones that are really close, or, are there a bunch that are really close, but nobody thinks that any of them are particular, I have to have this. And if everybody's I have to have are in gaps, then that helps us determine we really should just focus on gaps, and the other stuff maybe isn't necessarily salvageable or worth focusing time and energy on when what we should be doing is just looking at the gaps.
Thanks. Yeah. Okay. Your challenge over your Memorial Day weekend. No, you need a holiday. As you note, there are important dates coming up. Ann Cohen's going to have a baby. The survey will come out. You'll be sending it back. The faster that turnaround happens, the faster you'll get the review of the preliminary findings for you to comment on, right? And then by July 13th, the findings are due to HHS. We're hoping that this carries on beyond this. As Sarah was saying, there's another task order specific to duals, and we certainly have carved out a big chunk of work for ourselves to do ongoing. So hope that you all hang in there with us as we keep you updated about that progress. And thank you, Megan and Sarah, Amru, Alexandra, the folks out there who helped get us all up the elevators and whatnot today. Very good job on all of your parts.
Thanks, Alice.
Mm-hmm.